Legendary Beatles producer Sir George Martin has died, aged 90. During his six-decade career, he shaped the Fab Four into the world's most important pop music force, producing almost all of their recordings. Band drummer Ringo Starr announced Martin's death on Twitter. The Universal Music Group in Los Angeles confirmed it, but said details were not immediately known. Referred to as the fifth Beatle, Martin was producer, collaborator, and mentor to John Lennon, Paul McCartney, George Harrison and Ringo Starr. Martin was knighted in 1996. He was named the most successful producer ever by the Guinness World Records. He notched up more than 50 number one hit records in America and the UK alone. British Prime Minister David Cameron has paid tribute, calling him a giant of music.
peace and love.
Very nice. That sounds great.
Now the time has come.
And went.
Yeah.
2016, that is.
That's right. Ringo's Day of Peace.
And love.
September of this year.
It wasn't Ringo's Day of Peace. It was a Day of Peace declared by the United Nations, but he wanted a piece of it, so.
Yeah, so he had a piece of the Day of Peace.
With the All-Stars, such as they were this year.
So this is our review of the year 2016. And
yes.
What a year it has been.
I don't think I'm alone in being happy it's past us now.
Right. A lot of people are saying that.
Celebrity mortality.
Hmm.
Seriously. I mean, all the years I've been aware of the news, which is a lot, because you know, I used to deliver newspapers, so I kind of kept up on things. I can't recall a year where so many people died. It's like, you know, the memorial sections of the award shows, they're going to have to be like whole segments unto themselves.
Let's see who the Oscars leave out from their commemorative film.
Well, there's that.
It does seem to come and go in waves, though, with celebrity deaths. I mean, there are certain years that are notable for that. I remember 1980 being one, not just John, you know, finishing the year, but Peter Sellers died that year. And I know there were...
Burt Camford.
Right, yeah.
Larry Williams.
Right.
Bon Scott. John Bonham.
The first year I was aware of it actually was as a seven-year-old in 66, which was the year...
Al McCogan.
Yeah, that's right.
Johnny Kidd.
Yep.
Who else died in 66?
A guy called Arthur Haynes, who was a popular comedian on TV in England.
I thought you were going to say the underwear magnate.
No, not quite.
Okay.
Yeah. But anyway, yeah, so yeah, a lot of deaths in 2016 and also some political and cultural ones.
Really? I hadn't heard. We're going to focus on the Beatle-related things, obviously. There are, among them, the year was bookended by a pair of 90-year-olds in Beatle world who died. From the top, we have George Martin, who passed in March.
Yeah.
And then at the other end of the scale, we have Al Brodax, cartoon magnate. Besides George Martin and Al Brodax, in between we lost the man who coined the term Beatlemania himself.
Tony Barrow.
Tony Barrow, back in May.
Disca.
Yes, his record review column in Merseybeat.
Yeah.
Were you a subscriber?
No.
Oh.
At 3 years old, I was buying Merseybeat. I don't think so.
That's rather short-sighted. All right. Some collaborators. Leon Russell comes to mind.
Right.
Yeah. Who certainly left his mark in George's career. We have Stigwood.
Yeah.
Who nearly took over the Beatles' management.
Well, I wouldn't say that. Maybe nearly in his own head, but no, I don't think
Well,
so.
If Brian had gotten his way, because Brian was bringing him in.
Yeah,
although
but the Beatles made it very clear that it's never going to happen.
Right.
Yeah.
God Save the Queen Out of Tune.
Right.
Be their output.
Yeah.
Anyway, we'll
Greg Lake.
Greg Lake, yes, recently. Sad. Yeah. An all-star.
Yeah.
We'll circle back to the deaths. I mean, we want to start with something positive. Was there anything positive?
Let's end on a really bum note.
Yeah, that's the way to go. Because then you're glad the year's over, you see.
Yeah, exactly.
That's our sweet relief.
Yeah, there's method behind our madness.
Absolutely. So this is a year that, like the 1978 show, we can point to a couple of cinematic releases, Beatle-related.
Oh, yes.
One needs no further introduction, since we've raked it over the coals pretty thoroughly by now.
Yeah.
8 days a week. The other one we haven't seen yet, but that's not going to stop us from raking it over the coals. The Lennon Report. I did read a few good things about it. It is the film that came out timed to the week of John's birth anniversary, focusing on the emergency room doctors who tried to save his life. So it's not focusing on the killer, unlike a couple other films that came before.
Yeah,
not so much as John, other than this, you know, sort of MacGuffin in the room.
Right. I mean, it's not something that I was racing to see, to be honest with you. You know, it's a dark subject. It's not going to be a happy ending. You know, the story ain't going to change.
Right.
And so, yeah, I don't know if and when I'm going to get to that.
Yeah, it's not burning a hole in me to see that. Although there was a film that came out a few years ago, Let Him Be. Do you know about that one?
No.
It's a fantasy, and it's about John not dying, but instead letting the world think he did, and then going undercover like in upstate New York or something like
that. Like griddling burgers with Elvis.
No, it wasn't that. He actually was like a barroom musician. So he still stayed in music, but he got away from the whole identity. I've not seen it. I've only read about it. So I'm a little bit curious about that just because, well, you know, it's an alternate universe and, you know, the story as it happened in life doesn't play out that way. So that's a positive right there.
Well, if you say so.
I'm going to prove to you that it is John Lennon.
Oh my God, it is not John Lennon.
Hi there.
Yeah.
Hi, my name's Tim, and we're shooting a little documentary for film school about the changing...
You've been asking around here about us.
We've been asking questions about everybody, because we're trying to, you know, find out about how the old girls...
We're not interested, all right? We're not interested.
Why, is there anybody else who'd like to...
No, there isn't. Now piss off, will you? Piss off.
Get out of this property.
So let's go back to February.
The Grammys?
The Grammys, yeah. Mm. Paul was turned away from the party. Outrage.
Yes, that's right. That made the headlines, didn't it?
How VIP do we got to get?
I don't know.
They won't let you in. What?
Yeah, we need another hit, guys. We need another hit. Work on it.
I think you don't have enough.
Next year.
It's a little bit like the scene in Hard Day's Night, isn't it? When they have difficulty getting into the casino.
Yeah, right. Also, Dave Grohl performed Blackbird during the Bring Out Your Dead sequence.
Yes, that was pretty good.
Blackbird singing in the dead of night. Learn to fly all your life. You were on waiting for this moment to arrive.
I stoop for beer.
Blackbird singing in the dead of night. Take these sunken eyes, learn to see.
To us, Mr. Bond. Are the best.
You were only waiting for this moment to be free. Blackbird, fly. Blackbird, fly.
This was a year of a lot of anniversaries. I mean, the big one being the 50th of Revolver,
yeah.
Which is huge.
Yeah.
The 50th of them quitting touring, playing their last live show. I was glad to see Revolver get a lot of attention this year, a lot of love.
Right.
I mean, you know, we're going to probably see a rerun of this on steroids come June,
yes.
With Pepper. But I think the world is catching up to the greatness that was Revolver.
Well, maybe, but certainly Apple and EMI didn't seem to be catching up to it.
It would have been, you know, if the Beatles had been signed to Sony, you would have seen a box set of all the outtakes, all the run-throughs, the demos, you know, with great liner notes and everything. Those Robert Whittaker pictures in the studio, Freeman pictures, whoever it was that took them. Yeah. It would have been superb.
Talking of Sony, of course, they took back control of the publishing. From Michael Jackson's estate.
Yes. That was early in the year. So,
yeah, that was in March. Yeah.
What were the implications of that, you think? More product? I do know that this year we saw some stepped up Beatle music, not their actual recordings, but Beatle music and ads. Like that, whatever that EyeSight product is that has All You Need Is Love in it.
Yes.
Oh, good God.
I know.
Well, Lennon wore glasses.
Yeah.
So I suppose that means something, right?
Yeah, but I don't know what the implications of this will be. It's going to play out. But
every so often you hear it, McCartney is taking back control of his publishing, and it never goes anywhere.
I know, because that was a strong rumor, wasn't it, that he was going to grab
again.
It.
That's something either – I mean, I don't see him writing a check, but if there's some kind of legal provision where it's going to revert to him after X amount of years have passed or something like that, then maybe. But I never see the consummation of that. When it's being floated.
Most likely he's so sick over the fact of what he could have got it for and what he'd now have to pay for it that he just doesn't want to do that.
Do you think he's learned anything from that?
Do you think he ever learns anything from anything?
There must have been an awful lot of pressure on him to buy his own publishing to make him not do it.
Mm. Yes, that's right. Paul, you must buy your publishing. No one tells me what to do.
Right. Yeah. And we're going to do it. So, anniversaries. Jane Asher turned 70 in April.
Yep.
And what a fine-looking woman she is these days.
She is, actually.
Yeah.
A classy woman.
Yes. So classy, she's not written a memoir.
Correct, and she ain't going to.
No, she's not.
No.
She lets Peter do the dirty work and go out on the road and tell 60 stories.
Right, right. Yes.
But he's not, you know, I mean, yeah. It's got to be the Disney-fied version of it.
Hmm.
But it would seriously be interesting what kind of insights she could offer about the most impenetrable beetle.
Yeah, it'd be amazing, really, right? From 63 all the way through 68.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah.
There'd be a lot of insight.
And it's basically the biggest scope of the Beatle years.
I think it's because she's got so much she could say that she hasn't.
What's been your most embarrassing moment on stage?
Like everybody, it's when you can't quite remember what you should be saying next. And I think on the whole, I've managed to cover it up, hopefully. But I've had some horrible moments, yeah. I mean, it's just awful when you sort of feel the floor go beneath your feet and you cannot think what comes next. And I have once been in one of those terrible things, which we call a loop, where there are two bits of a scene that are very similar and you think you're in one bit and actually you're in the first one and you find you can go round again. You know, you actually find you're coming around and you can't think, where do I break it, you know? But audiences never seem to notice.
You're not the same. Yeah, a bit of your change.
I just wonder, just as a human being, how you can keep that in. Wouldn't you be screaming to tell the world, but you know?
Don't judge everyone by your standards.
It's very exceptional, and I'm glad. You know, otherwise she could have been, you know, putting out this know-nothing book.
Well, I mean,
which other people have.
Yeah. Patty didn't succumb until I think Eric did his book.
Exactly. That was what lit the fire under her.
Yeah.
It was a preemptive thing because she was afraid of how she was going to come off.
Right. Yeah. And then we know Cynthia certainly went to the well twice.
Yes, she did.
Yeah.
As did Pauline Sutcliffe.
Right. Maureen maybe just didn't live long enough to do it. I don't know.
Right. That's true. Mm. It would have been interesting. It's too bad she died so young.
Yoko assured me about, I don't know, 18, 19 years ago that she was going to be doing her book.
There's rumblings I've heard like recently about it being imminent.
Yeah.
And that, in fact, this was the quote that I read. It's imminent and the Beatles aren't mentioned in it.
Well, it's because she never heard of them.
Right. Except for Ringo, which means apple. It all ties together.
Yeah, I think I told you, didn't I, that I, years ago, is when the Lennon anthology box came out, in which she decided to go public about election night 72.
Yes.
And I thought, okay, well, if she's willing to do that, maybe she'll spill her guts about everything. So I sent a letter to the Dakota.
Yes.
And forgot about it. And about 3 months later, I got a bed-in postcard in an envelope and just scribbled on the front. It said something like, I'll write my own book. Thanks. Y-O. Yes, I'm still waiting.
Yeah. So you were inviting her to collaborate?
Absolutely, I was. Mm. Yeah. She could do half a book. That would be her specialty.
Right.
Actually, you said Jane Asher turned 70. That was in April. That was the same month that the anthology CDs were remastered.
Yes. And I have to say that I haven't repurchased them, so I can't really tell. I think it was done for iTunes.
Mm.
So I know that they had done a cleanup of BBC One when the second one came out, which was certainly overdue.
Right.
So, you know, I mean.
But you were mostly too busy getting your tickets for the All Stars Spring Tour.
I've not seen them in forever. And I have to say that the most interesting acts along the way that were part of that entourage seem to have died off.
Right.
The two members of the band, Levon and Rick, who I did see on that first tour. Clarence Clemens is gone. Billy Preston's gone. Greg Lake, as of this year.
Joe Walsh is still around.
He is still around. They're joined at the hip.
Yeah.
I would like to get to certain ones that did it once and never came back.
Right.
Like Dave Edmonds.
Mm, yeah.
That would have been
fun. I can't remember who was in the lineup when I saw them. That was, you know, back before I moved to the US, I saw them with Mark Lewisohn at the Hammersmith Odeon.
Oh, yeah?
And at one point, we just walked out. We just couldn't take much more of this. You know, Ringo was, you know, doing Yellow Submarine and turning it into a total sing-song. And
you didn't know his name when he called it out?
Oh, yeah, what's my name? Ringo. And he was doing his zigzag dance, giving everyone peace signs. And it was, you know, I remember just saying to Mark, Lennon isn't turning in his grave, he's spinning in it.
What would you have expected, seriously?
I don't think I expected anything. And I wasn't disappointed.
That's interesting. Hmm. I mean, I saw him on that first All-Star tour. And I think I kind of knew because there'd been a few shows already by the time I saw him.
Yeah.
And so I kind of had an idea of what it would be like. And you know, it was great seeing the guys from the band. It was always great seeing Billy.
Yeah.
Clarence Clemons, you know, if I'd known he was going to drop dead later, I would have thought, oh,
I remember Nils Lofgren was in.
Yes. Yeah. And he's a great guitarist.
I think Todd Rundgren was in there as well.
I don't think the first one.
No, this wasn't the first one.
Oh, okay, maybe yours. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But what did I expect? Seriously, I expected more drumming from him. You know, there was a lot where he wasn't doing the drumming and he was just like hitting a few percussion instruments in a very half-hearted manner. So that was kind of disappointing. I expected to see a bit more Ringo drumming.
Well, he did bring in Sheila E. ultimately. Mm. She played a bunch of tours with him.
Yeah.
I suspect did a bunch of heavy lifting. Actually, Zach was on that first tour.
Right.
Yeah. And that was great to see him.
So you weren't getting your tickets for the All-Stars Spring Tour. What were you spending your money on? The Pure McCartney CD, maybe?
The Pure McCartney CD. No, I don't own that yet. I mean, basically because I own most of it already.
Here's a surprise for you. I'm not going to.
I'm shocked.
Yeah.
Shocked and stunned.
Yeah, I mean, really. I mean, just some weird choices of the track listing, especially on the deluxe set.
Okay, well, define weird.
Bit bop? How about that?
Is it the demo?
Will that suffice?
All right. Let's look into this in depth. What do you think is missing? Let's start there. Frog chorus.
Some really good songs. Wow, keep them coming.
Hey, Wanderlust is on it.
Yeah, I love that.
Okay.
Yeah.
The studio coming up is on that.
Yeah, well, which is the one that we were familiar with in Britain. That was the big hit.
Well, except in America it was number one.
Yeah.
The live one.
The live one, I know.
Yeah, the good one. Credited to Paul, but it was actually Wings.
What did they do for the video in America? Because, of course, we had that great video that went with the studio.
Yeah.
So what did they do in America?
They didn't. It was 1980.
Yeah.
A record could still be a hit without a video.
Right.
I mean, if they did, I put it this way, I don't remember seeing one, but they got the great footage from Kampuchea, which was December of 79, so yes. They could have shown that.
Did they ever air the other video? I mean, when did you first see the other video?
SNL.
Oh, wow.
May of 1980, when Paul and Linda and Father Guido Sarducci were interviewed, so we got to see that. And I'm pretty sure that there was outlets like, I don't know if Night Flight was on yet, but the things that showed clips, it wasn't like it was scarce. You knew it existed.
Right.
I mean, they promoted the hell out of that video like it was this groundbreaking thing. And I suppose in 1980, you know, multiple characters and it took them a week to shoot,
yeah.
You know, might have been considered, you know, innovative.
So why haven't you got the Pure McCartney CD then?
I just buy things generally I try to that I would listen to, and that's not a diss on Paul.
Oh, no, that was a very positive statement.
Well, I make my own compilations, put it that way. I don't need somebody else to sequence stuff for me because I know what I want to hear and how I want to hear it.
So what have you compiled for him, a Greatest Hits EP?
Not an EP, mister. I got two full CDs worth of stuff.
Oh, wow.
Starting with Backwards Traveler.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah, is that
I cut it off before cuff
that, I think was going to be the title for the retrospective, wasn't it?
Backwards Traveler?
Yeah.
Hmm. Nobody asked me these things, but I would have weighed in for that for sure.
I bet that would dress me up as a Robert.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
Could steal, but you could not. Rob.
Rob.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you had that one ready.
I did. What would you have liked to have seen on this that you're not seeing on it?
In all seriousness, I don't see the point of it. Period. There have been enough greatest hits, McCartney.
Okay, which is the definitive one for you then?
None of them, because they always have omissions. I mean, All the Best, right? Which was what, 87?
Yeah.
I mean, it was
different in the UK than from here.
Yes. And I mean, you know, how many hits has Paul had since then that he needs to have another greatest hits collection?
Well, this is supposedly career encompassing.
Mm.
I mean, you're starting from 1970, so it is meant to sort of supersede the previous ones. I mean, there's a bunch of Lennon ones, you know, Working Class Hero, Lennon Legend, John Lennon Collection, Shea
Fish.
I don't
need all of them.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think at this point, it's almost better to let the listener collate their own.
Right.
I mean, I get to where if you're a consumer that wants a single, a one disc or two disc, so you're fulfilling the market demand for, do I want a bunch or do I want like one single CD, like Beatles One?
I mean, how many more live albums do we need from Paul and Greatest Hits albums?
I agree. But there seems to be a demand for live albums by people. Now, I don't know if he's going to put one out from Desert Trip.
Oh, talking of which,
yes.
Very nice segue
there.
Thank
you. October of this year.
I wanted to try and write a song that if it ever got back to the people going through the struggles in Alabama and Little Rock, that it might just help them with the struggles that we're going through. Blackbird singing in the dead of night. Take these broken wings and learn to fly. All your life, you will all be waiting for this moment to arrive. Singing in the dead of night. Take these sunken eyes and learn to see. All your life, you will all be waiting for this moment to be free.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
Yeah, that certainly got quite a bit of coverage.
At least now it makes sense that he agreed to play in the desert.
Why? Because he was parched.
He sounded so parched, yes. Mr. I don't drink water on stage for 3 hours.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Alongside, well, there's that fabulous version of Come Together from the Stones, that same
right
concert.
Yeah.
For anybody who hasn't heard that, you're in for something.
We've zipped forward to October for that one, but, you know, there's a lot that we've already left out. Still.
What was interesting about that whole thing, do you remember when Ringo earlier in the year, because he did two legs of his All-Star Tour. He did a spring one, then he did a concurrent one while McCartney was doing Desert Trip. He was on the road as well. And he had said something aloud in an interview about him and Paul, how he'd like to see them play together live.
Yeah.
I don't remember if he used the word tour or not, but he did float that idea. And then Paul did that cover story in Rolling Stone where he basically batted the whole suggestion away in like the most passive-aggressive way possible.
No, you shock me.
Yeah, and he didn't really give a reason other than to say no. But he didn't like put a negative spin on it or even a reason. He just was like, well, it's not going to happen kind of thing.
Well, a little bit like his response to Beatles reunions in the early 70s. You can't reheat a souffle. And
until you can. In this Rolling Stone interview, there's a lot of talk of touring because he's on the road doing Desert Trip, which, by the way, was with The Who, The Rolling Stones, Dylan. Yeah. And did you hear what Paul called it?
Go on.
Fossil rock.
Oh, yeah, pretty good, actually.
Right. So, I mean, he can be self-aware. But he gets asked flat out, would you ever consider doing a tour with Ringo? And this is, you know, after Ringo had floated the idea not long before. It's never come up. We come together for things like the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, but to actually tour together, leave well enough alone.
Wow. Nice.
So apparently he doesn't see the All-Stars as being a good fit for himself.
Oh, he prefers Abe on drums.
Well, and trotting out his hit, Mary Had a Little Lamb, Mr. Paul McCartney. Yeah, too bad.
In July of 2016, it was the 10th anniversary of Love.
Yes, and I guess they retooled the show.
Yeah.
For anybody who hasn't seen it to this point.
Right.
We'll be doing a show at that at some point.
We certainly will. It's a fantastic show.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I still love the Love album.
Right.
Some people so diss it for them not going far enough in the remixing. And
I know. But I agree with you. That is an album I do listen to.
Yeah. Yeah. I probably listen to that more than any other compilation.
Right.
Yeah, it's fun.
Me too.
And speaking of July, that was when they unearthed that Gary Wright album that had George on it.
Yeah, those collaborations.
Yes. And that he was a guy that, you know, he put out his book in the past year, Gary Wright's memoir. He had a very close friendship with George.
Keyboardist.
Yeah. And, you know, he plays on All Things Must Pass and Living in the Material World. And, of course, they did the co-write on the self-titled album, right. If you believe. So and then there was the Cabot show where Gary Wright has got that outfit called Wonder Wheel at the time, and George is sitting in playing a slide on Two-Faced Man.
Right.
Which has also got Mick Jones, not the Clash Mick Jones, but the Foreigner one, also in that band. So
not the Leeds United footballer Mick Jones either. You wouldn't know about that.
Probably not, but I'll have to check on that one. I always thought it was interesting that Gary Wright was not at concert for George because there's somebody that absolutely had the, you know, the ties professionally and personally.
Yeah, I wonder why.
Yeah, I mean, neither was Bob, so.
Right, yeah.
But I think Bob said he couldn't face it.
Oh.
Just as, you know, it's funny.
Foreshadowing his Nobel Prize no-show.
Right, exactly. But also, you know, he writes a song about John, who he had kind of a arm's-length relationship with.
Yeah.
But George, who he was very intimate in his friendship with and musical collaborations, I always suspected that it was too close to him to deal with. Just like Ringo never wrote a memorial song to John. Not really an overt, dedicated one.
Right, but in Bob's case, also, let's not forget that up until the last minute, George wasn't even sure that he was going to walk out on stage at Bangladesh.
Right, but then they went on to, you know, record together as the Wilburys, and so I don't doubt how tight they were.
Although George did criticize Bob, I remember, you know, during the Wilburys era for not making enough effort at times.
Oh, is that right?
I don't know if it was to do with videos or whatever it was, but he actually went public criticizing him for not making enough effort.
Didn't he know he was dealing with his Bobness? You don't dictate to.
Yeah, well, but this is George. You don't treat an ex-Beatle like that.
No, but truly, you know, when they did the what's called the Silver Wilburys gig, that club in California with John Fogerty and Dylan, and it was at that Taj Mahal show.
Yeah, was it called the Palomino Club?
Right. And I forget who else was on the stage, but. Yeah, I mean, clearly they enjoyed hanging out and playing together, and they had a nice friendship.
Yeah.
And I would really wonder what Dylan has to say, either in prose or in song, about that. I mean, beyond the soundbite he gave when George died.
Right. Yeah. So also that same month of July, the It's For You demo showed up, which was nice.
Yeah, they're going through Cilla Black's possessions following her death the year before.
Yeah.
Yeah, it turns up. And I have to think that more things like this are going to turn up that we know had to have been demoed.
Mm.
And this was, you know, a 1964 recording, a song that they had written for her.
Yes.
I always thought it was a pretty good tune.
Yeah, it was actually. It's one of those ones that you think they could have done themselves.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. And I think it didn't perform well chart-wise, but I know Cilla had said something like, well, there are no Backrack and David, or something to the effect that I think she was sort of laying its chart failure on the fact that Paul, who presumably did most of the writing on that, was overreaching in terms of a ballad style for her.
Yeah, well, there's gratitude for you, and, you know, that was it.
It's the woman that laughed at Tomorrow Never Knows.
Yeah, well,
I would expect nothing less.
I'd say someday I'm bound to give my heart away. If I do, it's for you, love.
We'll do a show in the future on these demos because there's really some cool stuff to talk
about.
Oh, yeah. That'd
be really interesting.
Yeah, for sure.
But now I do know where your money went this year.
Okay.
It was the very first pressing of the White Album, wasn't it? You got copy number one.
Who better?
Yeah. Sold in August. How much did you pay for it?
Millions. Broke the record there, but that was from Ringo's personal effects.
Yeah.
Who, you know, he's been getting rid of a lot of stuff and putting up for auction.
Yeah, divesting himself of stuff that he can realize some capital to pass on to his children and grandchildren.
Viva Chuck and Dave.
There you go.
It's interesting that stuff, I mean, you know, we'll never see it unless it ends up in, like, you know, Rock and Roll Hall of Fame or these traveling collections.
Now, do tell me more about the Ringo Day of Peace.
All right, for those who don't know, it's a UN-sponsored event on September 21st of this year. The Day of Peace observed around the world. Devoted to strengthening the ideas of peace both within and among all nations and peoples.
Yes.
So, you know, George's not around anymore. I don't know if he ever partook. You know, Paul, you know, he flashes the peace sign as well as anybody. I don't know what he was doing. John, presumably, you know, if Yoko decided to make an event out of it, he would have so been there.
But September was quite a month for Beatles fans.
There was that inescapable Ron Howard weighing in with 8 days a week.
Yeah.
As well as the Shea restoration.
And the good old Live at the Hollywood Bowl CD.
Yeah, the soundtrack, as it were.
Yes.
Is there anything we have left to say about this?
No.
Okay. Just to acknowledge it.
Yeah.
I'm sure people liked it.
But it was quite a month, really. You know, it's the sort of thing that we make the best of these days. We don't get that many releases.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it was exciting. I mean, maybe someday we'll look back at it a little more fondly than we are right now.
In all seriousness, we talked about, you know, Paul and Ringo performing live. In Paul's case, are you of the same mind as me that you actually wish he wasn't touring live anymore? Because I do get what people say that, you know, there will be a time when Paul isn't around anymore and we'll miss him.
Right.
And we will, despite all of my snarky little comments. I mean, the fact is, of course, it's great to have him around. And I understand people making the best of going to see him live. I personally would have preferred if he had retired, you know, from live performance when The Voice started to go.
Well, let me put it this way. I mean, yeah, I'm kind of two minds about it, and it just depends on what I get asked. But on the one hand, the opportunity for a lot of people to see what is history, you know, bring their kids or their grandkids to it, you know, that's something of value. And I can't say that the last couple of times I saw him that I was disappointed. Right. Yeah, I recognize, you know, is it quite on a Brian Wilson level of performance where it's clearly he's there sort of as a prop? No, it's not on that
level. They're beginning to copy some aspects of that, people filling in on the vocals.
Well, right. Mm. But if you go there and you have this illusion of him in his prime and he's performing these songs with great energy, you know, what's wrong with that? So I don't mind that. On the other hand, let's assume that his voice was in tip-top condition. Would it kill him to play more obscure stuff? I mean, it's interesting that, you know, he'll dig up something like Mr. Kite or All Together Now. You know, great. But his catalog is so rich. There's so much more stuff he could be doing. And there are so many songs I never, ever need to hear live from him again. The songs that he's got on every single live release, like Live and Let Die. You know, fireworks don't translate to a listening experience.
I wonder if they do any market research in terms of what people want to hear. Because I know, like Elvis, they sort of say, oh, he was always trotting out the same songs in concert. But apparently, you know, they would give the audience the option to submit requests before they went into the auditorium.
You're talking about Presley?
Yeah, with absolutely. And sure enough, it would be, you know, All Shook Up and Don't Pound Be Cruel. And, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Well, see, I like what Elvis Costello did with his spinning songbook, where he gave the audience the opportunity to come up, you know, with something that wouldn't necessarily be a natural choice for a set.
Right.
And the band was quite capable of playing it on the spot, which is pretty cool. Not to expect Paul to do something quite that innovative, but it would be cool. I mean, I don't think he's ever played Little Lamb Dragonfly live.
My problem actually with the live performances isn't so much the rockers where, you know, that you can belt still and you can have people filling in, but it's those ballads when the voice really wobbles or it disappears in some cases. It's not a case of me sitting there and enjoying that, like, oh, yeah, well, I can make a few more quips about Paul's crappy voice. It's actually upsetting and
sad.
Yeah, and it's uncomfortable feeling. You know, the same when I saw Sinatra on the ballads, again, the voice would really wobble at times and people would be glancing at each other sideways in the audience. You know, it's uncomfortable. It's not enjoyable.
Have you seen many acts where you were conscious when you're watching them that, boy, I wish this wasn't happening?
Oh, yeah.
Where they're past their prime?
Yes.
Like who? Well, Stones?
Stones, no, actually. I think they get away with it. You know, I think the Stones still get away with it. I think there's enough energy and even the whole thing of, you know, them just looking so decrepit. And,
well, because they're aspiring and identifying with these old blues guys.
Right.
That's kind of their out.
Yeah. So they're okay. It's really been McCartney and Sinatra, the two that really do come to mind. It's like they're well past their sell-by date and I wish this wasn't happening. In Sinatra's case, there was senility as well, you know, so...
Oh, yeah, forgetting of lyrics and
stuff. Well, no, forgetting what he's just said. So he...
Yeah.
I saw him at the Albert Hall, and he's introduced to the audience that his son Frank Jr. was conducting the orchestra. So he said, and here's my son Frank Sinatra Jr. And his applause, and then a joke. Yeah, his mother gave me a call and said he needs a job. Ha, 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 ha.
Okay.
And about 30 seconds later, the same joke.
Oh, boy.
And then 30 seconds after that... At which point, yeah, you know, people were looking at each other and it was like, wow. And actually even Frank Jr. just put up his arms to the audience as if to say, what can I do?
And this did not entertain you?
In the worst way. The next time I saw him, which was the last time I saw him a half dozen times. Last time I saw him was at the Desert Inn in Vegas and they'd figured things out then. He would just turn around and say, son, what are we doing next? And so, yeah, and Frank Jr. would just tell him and then he'd just do the song and he was reading everything off of monitors.
Yeah, I knew that in his lifetime it had gotten to that point.
Yeah.
Now, the end is near, and so I face that final curtain. My friends, I'll make it clear, I will state my case, of which I am certain. I have lived a life, and I walk each and every highway and more. much more. I did it my way.
Paul, I've seen a couple of times live in the past few years, but those weren't the worst experiences. The worst ones were where he was exposed on TV, like the opening of the Olympics.
Oh, the Olympics, yeah.
Things like that. Yeah. You know, the Grammys when he did Golden Slumbers. And
oh, yeah.
You know, it
oh,
just
man. You're taking me back.
I don't enjoy this. People may think I am actually having fun digging at him, but it isn't. I'm a Beatles fan.
Gloating.
And it's
pissing
not
on
fun.
His grave.
Yeah. I mean, I don't expect him to be sounding like he did when he was 35, but that's why I enjoyed Cut Me Some Slack, because at least it covered the flaws.
Yeah. It was suitable material for what he's got to work with.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, it's something that I think inevitably when he's gone, we're going to wish that he had been around longer to play live.
Yeah.
I thought of the idea. I wonder, I mean, probably not would he have it in him, either because he would think the audience wouldn't dig it or his own ego. But what if he went on stage and performed instrumentally, had like somebody contemporary singing his songs?
Yeah.
It would be interesting.
It would. Yeah. But I just don't think ego-wise he'd ever handle that.
Yeah.
You know, what it really requires is someone very close to him or a bunch of people around him saying, Paul, whatever you do, you must continue giving live performances and recording in the studio.
Yeah.
No one tells me what to do.
That would probably do it.
Now, there was a death of another kind.
A different kind of death?
A death of a Beatle-related marriage.
Oh, I thought you were going to say a death on stage. You're dying up there.
Terrible. See, it's not me, folks, who makes these derogatory comments about McCartney.
I think we're kind of role-switching today.
Hmm.
What is up with that?
Anyway, as I was saying, there was a death of a marriage, and it was Danny's marriage, Danny Harrison.
Again, following in his father's footsteps, not sticking with the blue-eyed blonde model.
Hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So watch, you watch. It'll be a brown-eyed brunette his next go-around.
Do you think he started writing Daughter of Beautiful Girl?
Well, maybe he's getting ready his version of Bye Bye Love.
Ooh.
Is his wife going off with a guitarist friend of his?
Well, if he was in a guitar duel, it's not surprising he lost.
Oh, that's interesting you say that, because I did read the other day that they're getting ready to make a film version of that whole thing. Layla and Other Assorted Love Songs.
Really?
Yes, The Romantic Triangle, yes.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, can you imagine?
Of course, my mind immediately goes to who are they going to cast as George?
Right. Who are they? Danny.
Actually, perfect. Right,
right. Right. Now yeah. He can relate.
Yeah. That would be really cool. I wonder if they bring Maureen into it.
Ooh. Who could play Maureen? Who'd play Ringo?
This is actually quite a fascinating thought.
Yeah.
But it's one that I dread, because I don't like biopics for that very reason.
Well, yes,
you know,
of
corny
course.
Scripts, stupid casting.
But the true life events were so unbelievable.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, this was a made-for-TV 1970s movie,
yeah.
Right?
So I wonder what they're basing it upon. Are they basing it upon Patty's reminiscences?
Book? I would think. I mean, she's not really let up as far as, you know, being active. And, you know, she still does the tour of her photos. And I know that she's doing the stuff with Mark.
Yeah.
So the fact that she's still revisiting the past for public consumption, it would not surprise me.
Right.
If that had been optioned.
Yeah.
I remember in one of my books, I referenced Wonderful Today as the title of her memoir, which is what it's called in Britain. And somebody goes, no, idiot, it's Wonderful Tonight, because that's what it's called in America. No, my signed copy is a British one.
Hmm.
Who's the moron?
Very acerbic. Mm. But anyway, back to Danny's divorce. What details do you know about that?
he filed.
Oh.
That's all I know. Oh, another interesting thing is that, you know, she started out, she was a model. That's what she was when they got married. Apparently, she's got a degree in psychology. She's a psychologist now. I mean, that's quite the career
pivot. I'm sure she needed it.
Maybe. But you know who else took a similar path was Jenny Boyd.
Yes, that's correct.
And she wrote a great, great book that is very interesting where she interviewed, you know, with her Rolodex, a circle of professional creative people. Mm. She'd been married twice to Mick Fleetwood, of course. And so, you know, she went to India. So she knew a lot of super creative people.
Yeah.
She wrote a book on the creative process, which is a fascinating book where she interviewed all these people and basically getting into their heads of how they do it.
Mm. I mean, that was my disappointment with the Patty book was that, you know, here she is, you know, in marriages with two of the great rock icons of our time, and there was just no depth to it.
I suspect that book had gotten rushed because she was trying to get it out before Eric's book.
She also had a royal biographer as a co-author, Penny Junior.
Yep.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Should have gone Penny Senior.
Well, you know, the problem there is with the author is the questioning. That co-author, a large part of her job is to actually interview Patty and get the stories out of her. If she doesn't know the questions to ask, you're not going to get the right material down on the page.
It all boiled down to, what was the MBE like?
It was interesting, but I didn't feel like I'd learned a whole lot more about either George or Eric after reading that book.
And clearly, while she has diaries, it was almost like they didn't reference them much because there were so many errors of fact and date in there that are wrong.
Mm.
It makes you wonder, you know, why was this even allowed to be published when it wasn't all it could have been?
Right.
It was done like, you know, she was under contract. She had a deadline. Let's get it done.
Anyway, while Danny was getting divorced, Patty was celebrating the first anniversary of her recent marriage.
I wonder if they're close.
They've been together many years.
No, I mean Danny and Patty. I mean, how would that relationship have unfolded through the years? Because clearly George stayed fairly close with Patty.
Yeah.
It was when... Who was it? Was it Patty's sister? No, it was Ringo's sister-in-law, Marjorie. There's a wedding picture that shows Patty and Olivia, you know, George in between them, standing there.
Yes.
So they're you know, obviously still in the same circles. Mm. There was, I think, a birthday party. It was some kind of thing where Ray Cooper's in the picture and Patty and Olivia are there next to each other as well.
And we got the photo of George and Patty at Friar Park in, I think, 1992.
Something like that. It's obviously a latter-day couple shot of those
I two. Saw them not literally standing together, but in the same orbit with the Carl Perkins TV special.
They were both there at the same time. Well, she was still with Eric then.
Yeah.
Yeah. So obviously they still had proximity to each other. So I just wonder, you know, Danny's born in 78.
Mm.
If he grew up, as he would with Ravi Shankar and those people, knowing Patty pretty well.
Auntie was Patty.
Exactly. I wonder about that.
God, it's always hurt me when he refers to Uncle Ringo. That's so ridiculous. Surely it's Uncle Richie. Everyone calls him Richie in the inner circle. But, you know, it's Uncle Ringo.
Who said that? Danny said that?
Yeah, I've heard Danny refer to Uncle Ringo.
Okay, well, that's his professional name.
Anyway.
Other deaths, if you want to go down that path.
Yeah, so let's go down the list of deaths this year.
December,
Sam Leach.
Yes. Cousin of Archibald.
Yeah, that's the rumor. I'm not sure if I believe that, but maybe others will come forward and tell us.
Sam Leach being the subject of that documentary that came out, The Sixth Beatle.
Yeah, I heard very bad reports about it.
What did you hear?
I heard that, you know, notes. Sam was basically saying that Brian Epstein stole the Beatles off him, that he should have managed them, and if he had managed them, oh, he would have taken them to even greater heights, I'm sure.
Even bigger than Elvis.
Yeah, there you go.
I didn't think it was a very objective documentary, to say the least. Mm. I mean, because not only did they throw Brian under the bus, but they also kind of elevated Pete Best, who is, of course, a consultant and a talking head.
Oh, well, there you go, yeah.
Yeah.
That's like Birth of the Beatles. You remember that biopic?
Yeah.
Keith, where...
consultant.
Pete's, yeah, Pete. Yeah, and Pete's in the cavern in there in one scene doing a drum roll, like, you know, you'd never, ever see him do in real life.
Well, except when he's at the top of the stairs and the drum escapes his fingers and... that would be a Pete Best drum roll.
There you go. So back to Sam Leach.
Sam Leach, yes. I think for most Beatle fans, if they've read... And they well should, the man who gave the Beatles away.
Mm.
There's a story in there about the Aldershot
gig, absolutely, where Sam booked, you know, this was like getting as close to London as they could to Aldershot, which is an army base just outside of London.
Yeah.
And but it's not the kind of place to be playing on a Saturday night. I mean, it's like, why Aldershot? But it was like, hey, it's down south. And
so that was the attraction for the Beatles.
Yeah. And, you know, it was him and I think it was Ivor Jay and the Jaywalkers or something. And Battle of the Bands, a band from London that no one ever heard of. The suspicion is that Sam forgot to advertise the gig. I think he claimed that.
They forgot they didn't run it in time.
You know.
Therefore, without the pre-gig advertising, 18 people showed up.
Well, and that was after the Beatles were running around to the local pub, sticking their head through a door, saying, do you want to come to a gig?
Right, right. But I guess, to be fair, Sam Leach had promoted a couple of shows before that where over 4,000 people showed up.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it wasn't pure incompetence.
No.
He knew what he was doing. Yeah, just in this case, it didn't pan out.
In this case, he didn't.
And it became a legendary Beatle event.
Well, yeah, because they played on for 18 people. Those fantastic photos that
are. Of George and John doing the foxtrot.
That's right, and all of them drinking Double Diamond beer with Sam in the photo and the photographer.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So here's a bit of Sam talking about this that we happen to have, thanks to a friend of the show, Ron Richter.
I had gone down to London because I realised what I had. I mean, I was trying to manage the Beatles. This is before Epstein came along. And I was making good money at the time. So I thought, I'll take him to London. We couldn't get a venue in London, so the nearest place we got was a place in Aldershot, the Paddy Borland, Queen's Road, Aldershot. I remember going to T.J. Burns, in one of the top London agents, and I remember saying to him, I said, T.J., this band are going to be brilliant. And his comment to me was, Sam, we've got 5,000 groups in London. Who needs the Beatles? And that was a comment which I reminded of many times after. I remember I went to his office a few years later to book Manfred Mann. And he's sees me and he's ducked back in his office. I said, I can see you hiding there, Tito. Mm-hmm.
But but what went wrong that night? Did you not
that
get
night? Well, what happened was I gave him a check for the advert and went. And with him not knowing me, the girl had taken the check by mistake, the girl in the office, put the advert in, left them no phone number because we didn't all have phones in those days. So the advert didn't go in because the cheque hadn't cleared until a week later, so it was too late then, once it got past on Monday. So they put the advert in the following week, but that was no good to us. We're in Aldershot, the Beatles are there, and there's no blooming advert in the papers. So we went around to all the pubs and clubs, and we managed to drag 18 people in to come and see the Beatles.
Did you say to the Beatles, even though there's so few people here, you've still got to do a show?
Oh, well, Paul was the one, I have to say, Paul was the one I said, persuaded him to still do the show. Paul was a real show business fella, you know, and he's still like that today. He loves the business. It's in his blood.
Yeah.
And it was quite comical. We had a football match afterwards.
And do you think that if you'd had a full house at Aldershot that night, you might have become the Beatles manager?
Well, what actually happened was the following week, there was 200 people there, just on word of mouth of the Beatles. And it might have happened, but that was sort of the last straw, because I didn't realise Epi was there at the time trying to manage them. And the following week, the bombshell dropped when the Beatles asked me, will I go and interview this fella Epstein and tell them what I thought of him? I couldn't believe it. Mm. I had to go and give them an opinion of somebody who I wanted to manage. Anyway, I remember I went and met Epstein, had a talk with him. Within 5 minutes, I realised that he was the man to do it. I thought he was a little bit green, but I felt that he was the man to do it. And without Epstein, I don't think the Beatles would have made it.
Towards the end of his life, I remember seeing that Sam was at the Hard Day's Night Hotel in Liverpool, which is actually a very nice hotel for anyone who hasn't been there. It's a beautiful hotel. And he would, I think, give lectures there or something.
Yeah, he definitely was working the fan event circuit. Yeah. And I've heard a lot of positive stories.
I saw him at a fan convention in Liverpool in the late 70s where he got up on stage.
Mm.
And I think at one point he was saying that, you know, the Beatles weren't super talented in those days. And I was shouting bullshit across the ballroom.
You showed him. We have two from Yellow Submarine. We mentioned Al Brodax, and there was Robert Baser, who was actually an animator in the film,
right?
Who died back in January.
Yeah. That was the same month that Stigwood died, and
Giorgio Gomelsky.
Yeah.
Yeah, who another people might be fans of the British Invasion stuff. He managed the Yardbirds.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he had some dealings with the Stones, too, along the way.
Yeah. Well, of course, one of Gomelski's main claims to fame is that he owned the Crawdaddy Club, where the Stones performed.
It had a residency.
In Richmond.
Yeah. And it was the Yardbirds that took over that slot from them. Yeah. You ever been to the Crawdaddy?
No. I've been to the Marquee, but not to the Crawdaddy.
How come?
Just didn't. Never been to Wimbledon either.
You've been to Ronnie Scott's?
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. In fact, I mentioned that the last time I saw Sinatra was at the Desert Inn in Vegas. I won that trip. It was actually it was a press launch for Sinatra's Duets 2 album. And we all gave in our press tickets at the door at Ronnie Scott's, and mine got drawn out.
Hmm. Well, second prize, two pairs of
two
tickets.
Two nights with me. Yeah.
Well, of course, the big death in January was David Bowie.
Yes, which we did a show about.
We did, yeah. And that's a, you know, I think I've said this on the show before. Had John lived, I would have loved to have seen a continuation of that collaboration, even if it was, you know, one-off, one-track per album or something like that. Because I think there is somebody, a true artist of, if not avant-garde, at least a sort of experimental and not necessarily traditional rock, that I think they could have drawn out the best in each other.
Yeah. I just don't know how close that bond was. I don't think it was that close. Even in the old Grey Whistle test, he says, you know, David, you know, I know pretty well, but I know Elton a lot better.
Well, right. He did know him a lot better. And they went back to the days of Dick James music. But David was a newer thing. And I think that if John had continued on a path of productivity and wanting to, you know he had it in him to innovate, but he didn't have the discipline or the focus to sustain it. And Bowie was all about that. You know, he was about to do his Berlin trilogy with Brian Eno. So it would have been interesting if John had stayed in the circle. You know, they used to have the same musicians.
Yeah.
So
John collaborating on Heroes with him.
Something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thanks, Yoko. Anyway, in February, another major Beatle-related death, Alan Rouse.
Yes. Alan Rouse, for anybody who doesn't know, when he died, was referred to as the modern-day gatekeeper for the Beatles.
Right. Yeah, which, Abbey Road.
Yeah, which, you know, he was an EMI employee. He joined Abbey Road in 72, but he was also a guy that had his hand in a lot of the latter-day Beatle releases, starting with Anthology. You know, he had a key role in that, in the BBC projects. He looked after and cherished everything recorded by the band and my father all those years ago.
Right.
Quote Giles Martin. Only Alan knew where everything was, and only Alan was trusted with preserving the tapes and the legacy of the most successful band in the history of recorded music. So let's unpack that for a second. Imagine what this guy's heard.
Right, yeah.
And given his reputation for being protective of them, I wonder if there's stuff such as Carnival of Light he is making sure that nobody ever hears.
Why would he do that?
Because he loved them. He wanted to keep it golden.
I don't know. I don't.
Yeah, I don't know.
I don't think that was
his
decision
to make. I'm just throwing stuff out there, Richard.
Yeah, you certainly are.
Mm-hmm. And that's what I do.
As you said, the gatekeeper,
you
know, and you just see his name on so many of the 80s and 90s releases.
That would have been a great interview. I mean, we know, okay, he's one of these guys that I've read the name a million times. I don't know that I've read that many interviews with him. But his death was enough to prompt Paul, Ringo, and Olivia and Yoko to issue a joint statement.
Yes.
So that's really something. Alan joined Abbey Road Studios in 1972. During his time there, made an invaluable contribution towards preserving the music and legacy of the Beatles. He worked on all the releases with extraordinary dedication and loyalty. Ah, loyalty. That's huge. Alan was a true friend of the band and of everyone at Apple, and will be remembered with great affection by those who were lucky enough to spend time working with him.
You know, I've written numerous press releases, and you always end up writing to a format, and it always sounds like a press release. I would sometimes try to mix things up, but the people who commission these things, they want it to sound like a press release, and it never sounds like the person who's being quoted. You know, it's clearly coming out of a PR guy's mouth.
Well, I'm sure that at some point they had their people sign off on that.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure they must have cast their eyes over it.
Do you think that they recall off the top of their heads what year he started at Abbey Road?
Right, yeah. But it's just so – it's kind of cold sounding. You know what I mean? These things –
You know
just...
who'd remember the day? Jeff Emmerich.
Oh, well, of course.
And what was said.
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. He would, yeah.
And what they had to say about George's playing that day.
Yeah. You beat me to it. March, George Martin died.
Yes.
Yeah. That was a huge, huge Beatle-related death, the biggest in recent times.
Yes. Would you call it tragic?
No, he had a great life.
Yes, he did.
Yeah, he had a long life, a great life, an incredibly productive life. Not just with the Beatles, you know, all the different people. And he's still in the Guinness Book of Records, being 38 weeks at number one in 1963 of his productions.
Ron Richards or him?
Yeah, there you go. So, no, I wouldn't call that tragic. Far from it. I'd say that it was just a wonderful life he had.
You're so cold-hearted.
I'm just level-headed, Robert.
Yeah, levelless. Another producer died, Chips Moman.
Do you think that was like an aftershock from the Ringo project?
Years later, it finally hits. It hit his bank account, that's for sure.
Someone I didn't get to interview amongst the producers.
Well, let's discuss what he did. That besides the unreleased Ringo album that he went to court to suppress.
Yeah, no, the Elvis in Memphis albums.
Yeah, is the thing that most people know him for, if they know him at all.
Yeah, his American Sound Studio was a really well-known facility in Memphis.
Yeah.
And that's where Elvis went back to for the first time, I think, in 14 years or something, after having recorded in Nashville for many years while living in Memphis.
Oh, exactly. I said right up the street, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, Moment started out at Stax,
mm-hmm.
and you know that itself was a studio that the Beatles at one point aspired to recording at.
Yeah.
So the one Beatle he got his hands on was Ringo, and not at the optimum time, of course.
I think you'd like to put both hands around him.
Ultimately.
Yeah.
And a knee.
Don't be cruel to a heart that's true. I don't want no.
Let's talk about also Tony Barrow. We mentioned him before. He's on a lot of those tours.
Have you read his book?
I haven't, actually. Have you?
I don't think I own it. No, that's
no. I never asked whether you own it. We know you never buy anything. But
I do own it, actually.
Hmm.
No, I bought it recently.
Okay.
But I think I read it in the library. His Tony Barrow Management was a artist rep for Kinks, Bay City Rollers, The New Seekers, Bob Monkhouse, David Cassidy,
right.
Gladys Knight, David Soul.
Okay.
Tony Bennett, Jackson 5, Andy Williams, and Neil Sedaka for their European tours.
Mm. A lot of MOR artists, basically. But hey, they're name artists.
Well, he grew up along with the artists.
Yeah.
He was 4 years older than the Beatles.
Yes.
Born in 36.
He's a good guy. I liked him. I always liked when he was interviewed in documentaries and stuff.
Well, it's funny you say that because we actually have some clips with him. Let's hear him talk now so you get a sense of his recollection of days with the Beatles.
People still ask me to name my favourite Beatle. Well, the truth is that I loved and hated each of them at different times during our working relationship. Paul, I guess, was the most ambitious. Paul was the most professional and the easiest to work with from my point of view because he understood my job. He understood what PR was all about. And he knew how to do publicity. He still does. Paul has always been a true showman from his bone marrow to his fingertips. He admitted when the Beatles began that he was determined to become a big star with or without the Fab Four, and he's remained a big star ever since the breakup of the band. George was the friendliest Beatle in the early days. I found him very easygoing, quite witty, and a very good listener. Unlike most pop stars, George didn't have an ego. He wasn't self-centred. He was the most serious musician of the four, and he took an academic interest in his instruments and those of the other boys. Before a show, he'd put his own guitars in tune, and then he'd do the others as well. George disliked travelling, especially he hated flying, so he found the concert tours a pain in the arse. But when the pressures of Beatlemania were at their peak, it was George also who was the first to be adversely affected. He became short-tempered and snappish, often upsetting the media by being uncooperative when they asked him daft questions. When Pete Best was drummed out of the Beatles and replaced by Ringo Starr in 1962, I remember asking John to explain to me the difference, as he saw it, between the two musicians, and he told me simply, "Pete is a drummer, Ringo is a Beatle." Ringo was content to stay in the background most of the time, and he'd go along with whatever everybody else decided. In the recording studios, he used to play cards with the roadies until he was wanted by John and Paul, who would tell him that they wanted him to do the drumming this way or that way. But Ringo also had a marvellously dry sense of humour, and after not saying a word for ages, he'd suddenly come out with the most devastating one-liner that would have the rest of us falling about. He came out, for instance, with catchphrases such as the classics, "A Hard Day's Night" and "Tomorrow Never Knows," came out with catchphrases without even realising he was doing so. He once told a TV presenter on Ready Steady Go, he said, "No, I'm not a mod and I'm not a rocker, I'm a mocker." And finally there was John. John was okay to work with, he was a professional, but on the personal level, he was also my biggest problem at the beginning. I felt that there was this invisible barrier somewhere between us. By now, I knew the others relatively well, and we got on together, but not John. He'd be making vicious jokes at my expense, and his attitude was generally unfriendly, unhelpful. Then one evening, we went to the Speakeasy Club, and over a lot of drinks, the barriers sort of came down. We talked for the first time about personal matters rather than business. We weren't talking about music, but about marriages and mortgages and raising children. We suddenly found in that conversation that we had quite a lot in common. I realised that a lot of his blustering and shouting was all bravado, which he often used to conceal insecurity and probably a certain amount of fear. Paul actually said once that the only way you get to see John is through the chinks in his armour. In John's eyes, newcomers were potential enemies until they had been proved otherwise. But once they were proved to be friends, that was okay. Until then, he was very slow to trust people. Because he made the most noise and played the tough guy, John was always looked upon by others as the leader of the Fab Four. But in fact, I believe it was Paul who held most of the power within the group. In dealing with Brian Epstein, John would have Epi in tears by shouting at him, and then it was Paul who would go in quietly afterwards and persuasively get everything he wanted out of Epi without raising his voice and without cracking the whip. Paul played the nice policeman, if you like, and John was the bad cop. So that was the Fab Four, looked at from the inside, from the so-called inner circle, which was my viewpoint and my workplace for 6 years in the 60s.
That's quite nice, actually, to hear that.
I'm glad we have it.
Now, in September, Richard Neville of Oz magazine died.
And we should explain to our listeners who might not know what Oz magazine was. Mm. Is there something you could correlate it to in America as far as a satirical publication that got politically in trouble?
Not that I'm aware of. You surely would be more familiar with that kind of thing. I mean, you know,
we have free
in the
speech
UK,
here, and it
we've
didn't
also
really
got,
happen.
In the UK, we've also got Private Eye magazine. I don't know if you've heard of Private Eye.
Oh, yeah. You know, yeah, they've had quite a bit to do with the Beatles for the years.
Yeah, absolutely.
Having goes at the Beatles.
Yeah.
The reason we care about this one, he worked for Oz magazine. He was an editor there, which is, you know, counterculture, if you want to sum it up in one term.
Yeah.
But when they were getting in trouble back in, what was it, 70, 71?
Yes.
It was the school kids issue, the infamous one, where they turned the editorial chores over to literally some people that were, what, high school age?
Yeah.
Yeah, Charles Shar Murray being among them.
Mm.
And it got in lots of trouble. And so the government stepped in to suppress, to put them out of business for being unsuitable and breaking obscenity laws and all sorts of things.
Mm.
And, you know, at the whiff of obscenity comes John. who's had such dealings himself.
Following on from his erotic lithographs raid.
And that led to the production of the song that was intended to raise cash for their defense fund, God Save Us, and Do the Oz.
Yes.
It was originally going to be God Save Oz, but he thought that was too obscure, so he made it God Save Us, and got one half of Splinter to sing the song, Bill Elliott, and it put it out as an Apple single in 1971. Did not chart.
Surprising. Let's take a listen. Why?
Okay, it goes to D and then A7 at the end now. So just remember the street, feet, seed, queen. Okay? Should we go then? Okay, you ready? 1, 2, 3, 4.
I always thought that was a decent enough recording.
It's okay, actually. It's fine.
I mean, the Lennon demo, we hear of him singing the vocal, but both of them. I mean, one's the Do the Oz is kind of hokey pokey.
Yes.
His version of it with, you know, the visual.
Hokey cokey, not hokey pokey.
In America, it's hokey pokey.
Is there a song, Do the Hokey Cokey?
Or, yeah. And that's what it's all about.
Yeah, and you sing Do the Hokey Pokey?
Yeah.
God, you would, wouldn't you?
You know what? You guys screwed it up in translation there.
Well, it was the hockey cocky, you see, and then you turned it into the hokey pokey.
And so that's like the Two Virgins video accompanying that?
Really? The hokey pokey?
Come on. God,
you've got to change everything. You know, it's not good enough to drive on the wrong side of the road.
Mel, we create the music. You guys do your versions of it.
Oh, yeah. Right. Yeah. The hokey pokey. There you go. Now I know what you're up to.
That's what it's all about.
So, Curly Putman Jr.
He was the claim to fame. He was one of these country artists that was more renowned, I think, as a writer than as a recording artist, although he was both. Green, Green Grass of Home.
Right.
You know
Tom
that
Jones.
Song. Yes. It took me years to figure out the punchline of that song.
Here Blitz. Comes Mary.
No. That he's about to be executed.
Uh-huh.
So he's returning to his home just to be buried under the green, green grass.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't listen to the words that closely. I just thought, you know, okay, he's nostalgic for home.
It's one of those songs, right? It's like another one that Elvis sang, which was Long Black Limousine. The woman that always said that, you know, she'd come back to her town in a long black limousine, and she has.
At a funeral?
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
People got a kick out of that stuff back in the day.
So anyway, go on. Carry on about old Curly Putman.
Okay. Why we care about him is because he was the host for the McCartneys and Wings in 74 in Nashville when they came to town.
Yeah.
And I guess he absented himself. He was on a trip or something, but he put his farm up. So there was all those great pictures of them in Nashville. Paul and Linda taking tea on the porch of Curly's home.
Yes.
Linda with the unshaved legs. And riding around on the motorbikes around the house.
That's a very, very harsh comment about her unshaved legs.
It
Not
was the
70s. Chooses to, Robert.
She was a liberated woman.
You know, have you ever been
You know what
Italy?
Else was liberated on Linda?
Go on.
Never
what?
Mind. check out the pictures. They speak for themselves.
God, that's so sexist.
That's sexist.
Well,
they came a long way, baby.
Anyone who objects about this, direct them at
RB at RichardBuskin.com.
Yeah, right. So Junior's farm then they were staying on.
Yes.
Yeah.
Hence that's where the song came from.
Is that where they One saw of your Ollie favorites? Hardy jumping a fence with a Gigi?
You know it.
Just for the sake of a couple of pence.
Yep.
Mike Pence.
That's one. Ponce. I love that word. We don't have the American equivalent here.
Really?
Ponce, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Well, at least nobody used it in common speech.
Vinny Poncia Jr.
Well, you know where I first came across that word? It was in, I think, In His Own Right.
Yeah, you dirty little ponce.
Yeah, it? Something yeah. like that. Yeah.
So a man who ponces off of women, he's
living off their dirt.
Yeah.
Anybody we know?
You maybe.
Junior's farm, take 16. One, two, three, four. Just to make a time.
November, the same month that Al Brodax died, Leon Russell.
Leon Russell. Beware of Darkness. He did a nice version of that, which we've played on the show before.
Yeah.
It gratifies me that he had a bit of a comeback late in life.
Yeah.
Where Elton John dug him up and put him on tour and did that project with him.
Nicely stated again. Dug him up.
Well, okay. Reached down and got him.
Oh.
Seriously.
Oh, that's so much better.
Well, okay. You know what I was actually genuinely moved by? Hmm. Is his Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction speech.
Great to be inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. But I have to tell you, something else that's also great. About a year ago, Elton came and found me in a ditch by the side of the highway of life. He took me up to the high stages with big audiences and treated me like a king. And the only thing I can say is, bless your heart.
See, so he kind of echoes those sentiments.
Mm.
It's not being unkind.
Yeah.
It's just how he saw himself. But I'm glad that he got that second wind, as it were.
When was the first time he played with a Beatle? Was it Bangladesh or did he play?
Prior to, because George is on his self-titled album from 1970.
Right, okay.
Yeah. In fact, let's play a bit of that just to, you know, George a mile away. Good stuff from Leon.
Yeah.
And also, as we played on the George show, that song Tired of Midnight Blue, that's him on piano.
Yes.
As well. So it worked both ways.
He's the guy with the long blonde hair in the Bangladesh concert.
Doing the Young Blood, Jumpy Jack Flash.
Yes.
And which is, you know, pretty decent, upbeat highlight of the show.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's not everybody's cup of tea, but amidst a lot of what was very somber music, a lot of it, you know, it was a standout for sure.
So we come to December of 2016, and kind of appropriately, sadly, Greg Lake died, December being associated with Christmas, and that was his big solo hit, wasn't it?
I Believe in Father Christmas, yeah. It's a little eerie that that's being on the airwaves at the same time word of his death comes, but no less so than early in the year, the death by self-inflicted hand of his partner, Keith Emerson.
Yeah, amazing. Both in the same year.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Keith chose his, but Greg was cancer.
Yeah.
Very sad. Mm. I don't know how much attention they get anymore, when considering how huge they were in the 70s.
Right.
I mean, a great, great live act. Mm. And he, of course, had the background in King Crimson.
Yes.
You know, he, again, not exactly a household word for a lot of people, but yeah, it was a sad death, not quite expected. And Carl Palmer lives on. In addition to everything else, he was, of course, a member of the All-Star Band.
Yeah, which is why we're mentioning him.
Right. Lucky Man was one of his spotlights. Hmm. Yeah.
Why don't we take a listen to a little bit of that?
Yeah, for sure. A bullet that found him, his blood ran as he cried. No money could save him, so he lay down and he died. Ooh, what a lucky man he was. But something I recently found out reading an interview with Greg Lake right after he died, he was talking about the song Lucky Man that he played on the All-Star Tours and how it was one of the first compositions he wrote. And he conceived it as sort of this folky ballad. And so he was working in the studio alone, laying out all the vocal parts and, of course, the guitar parts and the bass parts. And Keith Emerson came in and heard what he was working on. He's like, wow, I want a piece of this.
Yeah.
And so that great synth part, that real standout performance you hear at the end of the track, he had just accepted delivery of a synthesizer like recently and was trying it out and putting it through its paces. And Greg Lake was running tape on him. And he basically took this sort of experimental stuff that wasn't necessarily conceived for the track and imposed it on the finished recording. Mm. And Keith himself was nervous, like, really? This is what you want?
Yeah.
And Greg's like, no, it's great. It's great. And, you know, I think a lot of people concurred because it's one of their more memorable songs.
And one of those happy accidents.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. So anyway, we're going to sort of play out this show.
Circle back to George Martin.
Yeah, he's the big name on the list for us as Beatle fans.
Yes. And probably most people aren't familiar with the act he produced post-Beatles, the Mahavishnu Orchestra.
Right. And he actually did say on record that that was one of the, you know, his favorite projects that he ever worked on.
One of the best things he'd ever made.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah.
And they were, how would you describe them? Sort of a progressive art band?
Yeah, sort of jazz fusion.
Yeah.
A very interesting collective. You know, you've got John McLaughlin on guitars. And,
right.
And you got Gail Moran playing keyboards and vocals.
Yes, the female voice.
Yeah, Jean-Luc Ponty, electric violin.
Yeah, I was familiar with him from his solo albums. He was a French violinist who played the electric violin, as you said, and had some success.
Ralph Armstrong on bass.
Mm-hmm.
My good friend Narada Michael Warden on drums.
The producer. And vocals.
Yeah, I mean, I did the Whitney Houston book with him. Yeah, Narada actually produced and in some cases wrote many of Whitney's greatest hits. So he was on drums. Michael Tilson Thomas as a conductor and pianist.
Jeff Emmerich, engineer.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, it's a really interesting track, this. It goes through different phases. Smile of the Beyond.
That's the closing track on side one.
Yeah.
From the Apocalypse album.
Correct.
April of 74, which was around the time he was working with America as well.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Jeff Beck.
Right, yeah. Oh, Blow by Blow.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, there's an album.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So anyway, we'll play out with Mahavishnu Orchestra's Smile of the Beyond.
From George Martin's second favorite album.
My name's Richard Buskin.
This is Robert Rodriguez.
And this has been
Something About the Beatles. In 2016.
Something About the Beatles, produced at Studio Media Recording, engineered by Scott Steinman, executive producer Rick Way. Title song by The Corgis.
Yeah. Okay.
Never has a death brought him so much pleasure.
Well, I wouldn't go that far. It's the idea of it. It's meta humor.